Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. Have I ever mentioned to you guys that I love stories?
Yeah, you have.
And that I love your stories even more?
Smart boy, got a mind like a steel trap, full of mice.
Okay, we have two more from you guys. One is called My Graveyard Story, and the other I've titled Joey and Kung Fu Fighting. We also have a very old science fiction story from LibriVox.org called The Power and the Glory.
Wait, do we have a 5-minute mystery?
Of course we do.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by Superior Acting, which this story sadly lacks. In fact, I've seen more emotion from a turned-over journal. The story is good, even if our actors sound like they've done a few too many 5-minute mysteries.
Good morning, Sheriff.
Morning, Deputy.
Ted just called in and said he'd be late. Springfield bus from Cleveland broke down just outside of Cleveland and won't be in till 11 o'clock.
Well, I guess you and I can handle what little business we get here in Springville until then. Oh, Sheriff's Office. Speaking. James Coburn shot? Be right there.
Sheriff, the bullet entered his right temple just over the eye, passing through the head and made its exit from the back of the neck.
I knew this would happen to James.
You knew this would happen, Miss Alice?
Yes. You see, Sheriff, some man in Cleveland had attempted to blackmail James because of an earlier romance, and James had threatened to turn the blackmailer over to the police. Because of that, his life was threatened. I had him come here to Springville to hide out for a while.
Deputy, have any strange men been reported in town the last few days, or have you seen any suspicious characters that might have been trying to locate James Coburn?
Oh, haven't heard of a soul, except some bum that must have dropped off a freight. A short, swarthy-looking guy.
That sounds just like the Cleveland man. James described him to me one day.
Don't recall anyone saying he'd inquired about Coburn.
James always seemed like a pretty upright man to me.
Oh, James was a very quiet man, Sheriff. He was just unfortunate enough to have been tied up with this affair in his youth. And then this gangster had to try a shakedown on him and ruin all our happiness. We were to be married. We were going to be married tomorrow and go to Cincinnati to live. James had a job offered him there.
I'm sorry. This has been a shock to you, then.
Yes, it has, Sheriff. James had written me last week. He asked me to come on the 8:30 bus today. Then we were going on to Cincinnati this afternoon. Oh, I was so happy. I packed all my things and left Cleveland on the bus early this morning. I rushed right out here only to find him dead. Oh, if only he'd gone to Cincinnati months ago as I begged him.
It would have been just the same, Miss Alice.
Well, it couldn't have been. He'd have been safe there.
No. No, you'd have tracked him there and murdered him just like you did here.
Do you know why the sheriff accused Alice of murdering James Coburn? In just a moment, we shall find out. But first...
Wow, how underwhelmed they all seemed. I guess they just don't get it. High energy creates high emotions from the listener. By the way, I don't see any reason to suspect the girl, but hey, I'm sure that detective will fill us in and, while doing it, give us some key information that we lacked.
And now for the solution to our mystery.
Alice, James Coburn was shot by someone facing him as he sat in the chair. Obviously, someone from whom he didn't fear violence, therefore not a man. You were the blackmailer, if anyone was, Alice. He probably laughed at your threats today, went back to reading, and you shot him. You said that you arrived this morning at 8:30 on the bus from Cleveland. You couldn't have. That bus broke down, and one of my own deputies is still stranded outside of Cleveland on that bus. Come along.
Therefore, not a man? What a statement. That would not fly in this day and age, let me tell you. But hey, maybe in the 1940s, women were no threat. I do have to say that the story was well thought out. I totally missed the Cleveland bus clue. That was a good one. This 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by Superior Acting.
What's that you say?
I say we have an email from Brandon White. Brandon writes, I was listening to your podcast and have decided I like the idea of splitting the podcast from the radio show. I'm also glad that you're going to provide both as podcasts. I want to do something to help the show, but I can't sing, talk good, or know anything about podcasting. What can I do? Well, you help the show every time you listen, and I want to thank you for that. If you want to, do take a minute and write a review. That is one of the most powerful tools we have to grow the show. You can do that on just about every service we're on. If you use iTunes or the Apple Podcast Player, they've made the review process very easy. You can just click on the stars, or if you want, click on the stars and leave a comment. Whatever you do helps. Also, tell a friend about the podcast. That may be our most powerful tool. Did you know about the brand new Ron's Amazing Stories Echo skill? To activate the skill on your Echo, simply say, "Activate Ron's Amazing Stories." Now, there is a catch to this. For right now, you can only use the skill in the United States. I've been told that that's going to change, so stay tuned. Other countries will follow. I'll keep you posted. Ron's Amazing Stories is also an on-air radio show. We're on every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific. That's 11 p.m. Eastern. Coming soon, the radio show and the podcast will be parting company. In other words, for the most part, they will no longer have the same content. Stay tuned for more information on that and head to amfm247.com. And now, this brand new segment.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
I've been thinking about this a lot. I have mostly included your stories into the What's That You Say segment. Others. Nothing wrong with that. I've always thought that the segment should be used for answering emails rather than reading stories. So, I want to introduce These Are Your Stories, a new segment just for your stories. Now, we have two submissions this week. The first one comes from Daniel Conti of Raleigh, North Carolina. Daniel sent in his story via Facebook in his own voice. Unfortunately, I was not able to use that recording, so I transcribed it and sent it back to Daniel for his approval. Well, he gave his thumbs up, and here is his story. It was the early 1980s when my story occurred. I was a 10-year-old kid living in outer Washington, D.C. One night, my dog Joey and I snuck downstairs into the basement to watch kung fu movies on late-night TV. Joey and I were well into a show when I felt something odd that compelled me to look upstairs. What I saw, I will never forget, and you will not believe. There was a short, glowing creature looking down at us. He had some sort of apparatus attached to himself and looked very strange. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I even asked Joey, "Are you seeing this too?" His response was quick. Joey is a boxer with lightning-quick reflexes. He tore after the thing and chased it around the house. I had no choice but to follow after my dog all the way to the front door. It all ended there, and we were left alone. Joey and I went back down to the couch, where we sat down, totally confused. Neither of us were able to sleep that night. For those of you who are not sure about my story, I say this. I know this happened because my dog saw it too, Daniel. Daniel, that is a truly out there story. As I listened to you tell it on your recording, I could hear in your voice the sincerity of it all. I believe you saw something, and I'm quite sure I want nothing to do with what you saw. Thank you, Daniel, for sending in your story. Our second story comes from our old friend, Tom Williams, in Berlin. He sent us this humorous graveyard tale that should not scare anyone, but should remind us to never judge a book by its accent. Tom recorded the story for us, so here is, in his own words, a story he simply called My Graveyard Story.
I went out to my mother-in-law's to clean up our gravesite after the winter. Forgetting the watering can, I looked about to see if there was one loosely lying about. There was no one except a little old lady over at another gravesite, so I decided to walk over and see if she had one, which she didn't. And I asked her, in my best German, "Do you know where I can get a watering can?" She, of course, had learned a little bit of English in school, as many Germans have, decided to respond politely in English. And she pointed in the general direction of the entrance to the cemetery and said, "Go to hell," and smiled and went about her business. I thought, my, this really is a rude person. Did it on a friendly basis, but rather rude. So as I left the graveyard, on the left, just before the main entrance, I saw another tombstone. And behind the tombstone was a watering can. But on the tombstone itself, it said, "Mr. Hell." Never make quick judgments of people.
Two more great stories for you guys from you guys. I want to thank both Daniel and Tom for sending them in. That was some good stuff. Now, if you want to hear your story read on Ron's Amazing Stories, just do it. All you have to do is go to ronsamazingstories.com, click on the contact tab, and fill out the form. Now, here's some good news. By Friday this week, I plan to have a brand new story submission system installed. Basically, it's going to make the process of getting your story online much easier. Now, the reason I'm doing this is because in the past, I've had some problems with people leaving their full names and, more importantly, their permission for me to even use the story. So I'm hoping this form solves all that. I'm going to have a major link to it at ronsamazingstories.com. Give that a try and send your story in today.
Johnny, is this true?
Okay, I like to surf the internet looking for stories and other oddities. I do this in the name of the podcast, but the truth is, it's fun to see what's out there. What you're about to hear is what I call...
Johnny, is this true?
I will tell you a story and then ask the question, did I make it up or is it true? Let's get started. Story 1. Haley Sherman was walking her dog in the suburbs of Dallas, Texas in April of 1980. Her plan was to walk around the block and return home. This was a nightly ritual, and she always left at the same time, 7:30 p.m. Dinner was done, the chores complete, and the kids were working on homework. However, on this spring night in April, she did not return. Her husband, Earl, became worried and ran around the block looking for her. He found no signs of his wife or their dog, Brandy. He found no clues at all and called the police. They came and also had no luck finding the missing woman. 24 hours passed, and the local news was alive with the story. Everyone was looking for Hilly. Another 24 hours passed, and at precisely 7:45 p.m., she walked into her house like nothing had happened. Earl was furious and asked her where she had been. Hilly was very confused because, to her, no time had passed. They went to the hospital and found nothing wrong with Hilly or Brandy. To this day, Hilly has no memory of those missing days. Now, is this story true or just a fantasy created in my twisted mind? This is total trash, but I do think it's one of my better creations. I used an online name generator and literally threw a dart at a map of the United States. Gotcha. Story 2. A man living in Japan set up a security camera because he suspected that someone was stealing from his kitchen. He thought it might have been an animal, but when he saw the footage, well, it turned out to be a woman who would emerge every night out of his cupboard, eat his food, and even take a shower. Now, is this story out of the closet or work of a demented mind? If you said out of the closet, you got it right. She had apparently been living there without the man knowing for an entire year. Now, if you doubt my word, you can review this story for yourself on YouTube. Just search for Woman in a Closet. Story 3. Although English philosopher Jerry Bentham passed away in 1832, that hasn't stopped him from continuing to attend classes. In fact, his body has been sitting in a corridor at the University College of London since 1850. Is this one true? Did you say true? Then pat yourself on the back. Bentham, a man ahead of his time, wanted his head to be mummified and displayed on top of his actual skeleton, clad in a black suit. Unfortunately, the hem embalming left something to be desired. Okay, quite a bit. Bentham's head casing came out more beef jerky than man. Dismayed, school officials commissioned a wax head for the display. What happened to the old one? Well, it got tossed between Bentham's feet. In 1975, students from the college kidnapped the poorly preserved head, holding it for ransom. They demanded £100. School officials countered with 10, and the students caved. Now, it didn't stop there. Once, the teachers had to break up and recover Bentham's head from a game of soccer. Finally, they got the hint, removed the head to the conservation safe in the Institute of Archaeology, where it remains to this day. Story 4. Clyde Reynolds of Mason County was taken to jail for a very unusual crime. Clyde is a student of crime. He has studied all the famous ones, from the Alcatraz escape to the legendary Brinks robbery. He convinced himself that he could commit the perfect crime. But there was a problem. He's basically a law-abiding citizen. So, how to prove himself? He would steal a fully completed hazelnut mocha coconut milk macchiato from a major coffee company. Sound crazy? Well, it was the stuff of genius. He hired a group of friends to help him pull it off. Each one would order the beverage and pay for it. Clyde would step in, pretend to be that customer, take the drink, and abscond with it. The friend would throw such a fit that the barista would be distracted by the ravings, giving Clyde ample time to get away. Perfect. What Clyde didn't count on was 98-year-old Sarah. The elderly woman hit Clyde so hard with her pocketbook that he was rendered unconscious. Police came and took him away to face his deeds. Now, is this coffee myth, or did it really happen? Well, if you said this one happened, then I fooled you. Not only did I make this up, but I had a whole lot of fun doing it. The only truth in this story is that you can actually buy a hazelnut mocha coconut milk macchiato at Starbucks. How about that? Do you have any strange but true stories you want to share? If you do, send them to ronsamazingstories@gmail.com, and I'll use them if I can.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we have an astounding story that was written for the Pulp Mags in 1931 by Charles W. Diffin. Charles was an engineer, airplane salesman, and author who graduated with a degree in analytical chemistry from the University of Buffalo, New York. He was most active with the magazines published by William Clayton and Street & Smith. He was one of the better writers whom Harry Bates encouraged to write for Astounding Stories. Diffin also wrote for other companion pulps like Strange Tales. Our story is quite unique and gives us an idea of just how savvy people were in the 1930s about their future. It is titled The Power and the Glory and is read for us quite well by Robert Dixon.
Recording by Robert Dixon. The Power and the Glory by Charles W. Diffin. There were papers on the desk, a litter of papers scrawled over in the careless writing of indifferent students with the symbols of chemistry and long mathematical computations. The man at the desk pushed them aside to rest his lean, lined face on one thin hand. The other arm, ending at the wrist, was on the desk before him. Students of a great university had long since ceased to speculate about the missing hand. The result of an experiment they knew, a hand that was a mass of lifeless cells, amputated quickly that the living arm might be saved. But that was some several years ago, ancient history to those who came and went through Professor Edinger's classroom. And now Professor Edinger was weary. Weary and old, he told himself, as he closed his eyes to shut out the sight of the interminable papers and the stubby wrist that had ended forever his experiments, and the delicate manipulations which only he could do. He reached slowly for a buzzing phone, but his eyes brightened at the voice that came to him. "I've got it! I've got it!" The words were almost incoherent. "This is Avery, Professor. Avery! You must come at once. You will share in it. I owe it all to you. You will be the first to see. I'm sending a taxi for you." Professor Edinger's tired eyes crinkled to a smile. Enthusiasm like this was rare among his youngsters, but Avery, with the face of a poet, a dreamer's eyes and the mind of a scientist. Good boy, Avery. A long time since he had seen him, had him in his own laboratory for 2 years. "What's this all about?" he asked.
"No, no," said a voice. "I can't tell you. It's too big. Greater than the induction motor. Greater than the electric light. It is the greatest thing in the world. The taxi should be there now. You must come."
A knock at the office door where a voice said, "Car for Professor Edinger," confirmed the excited words. "I'll come," said the professor. "Right away." He pondered as the car whirled him across the city on what this greatest thing in the world might be, and he hoped with gentle scepticism that the enthusiasm was warranted. A young man opened the car door as they stopped. His face was flushed, Edinger noted, hair pushed back in disarray, his shirt torn open at the throat.
"Wait here,"
he told the driver and took the professor by the arm to hurry him into a dilapidated building. "Not much of a laboratory," he said, "but we'll have better, you and I. We'll have better." The room seemed bare with its meagre equipment, but it was neat, as became the best student of Professor Edinger. Rows of reagent bottles stood on the shelves, but the tables were a litter of misplaced instruments and broken glassware, where trembling hands had fumbled in heedless excitement. "Glad to see you again, Avery." The gentle voice of Professor Edinger had lost its tired tone. "It's been 2 years you've been working, I judge. Now what is this great discovery, boy? What have you found?" The younger man, in whose face the colour came and went, and whose eyes were shining from dark hollows that marked long days and sleepless nights, still clung to the other's arm. "It's real," he said. "It's great. It means fortune and fame. And you're in on that, Professor. The old master," he said, and clapped a hand affectionately upon a thin shoulder. "I owe it all to you, and now I have learned. No, you shall see for yourself. Wait." He crossed quickly to a table. On it was an apparatus. The eyes of the older man widened as he saw it. It was intricate, a maze of tubing. There was a glass bulb above, the generator of a cathode ray, obviously, and electromagnets below and on each side. Beneath was a crude sphere of heavy lead, a retort, it might be, and from this there passed two massive insulated cables. The understanding eyes of the professor followed them, one to a terminal on a great insulating block upon the floor, the other to a similarly protected terminal of carbon some feet above it in the air. The trembling fingers of the young man made some few adjustments, then he left the instrument to take his place by an electric switch. "Stand back," he warned, and closed the switch. There was a gentle hissing from within glass tubes, the faint glow of a blue-green light, and that was all until, with a crash like the ripping crackle of lightning, a white flame arced between the terminals of the heavy cables. It hissed ceaselessly through the air where now the tang of ozone was apparent. The carbon blocks glowed with a brilliant incandescence when the flame ceased with the motion of a hand where Avery pulled a switch. The man's voice was quiet now. "You do not know yet what you have seen. But there is a tremendous potential there, an amperage I can't measure with my limited facilities." He waved a deprecating hand about the ill-furnished laboratory. "But you have seen." His voice trembled and failed at the forming of the words.
"The disintegration of the atom," said Professor Edinger quietly. "And the release of power unlimited." "Did you use thorium?" he inquired.
The other looked at him in amazement, then, "I should have known you would understand," he said humbly. "And you know what it means." Again his voice rose. "Power without end to do the work of the world. Great vessels driven a lifetime on a mere ounce of matter. A revolution in transportation, in living." He paused.
"The liberation of mankind," he added, and his voice was reverent.
"This will do the work of the world. It will make a new heaven and a new earth. Oh, I have dreamed dreams," he exclaimed. "I have seen visions, and it has been given to me, to liberate man from the curse of Adam. The sweat of his brow, I can't realize it even yet. I am not worthy."
He raised his eyes slowly in the silence to gaze in wondering astonishment at the older man. There was no answering light, no exultation on the lined face, only sadness in the tired eyes that looked at him and through him as if focused upon something in a dim future or past.
"Don't you see?" asked the wondering man. "The freedom of men, the liberation of a race, no more poverty, no endless grinding labor."
His young eyes, too, were looking into the future, a future of blinding light.
"Culture," he said, "instead of heartbreaking toil, a chance to grow mentally, spiritually. It is another world, a new life." And again he asked, "Surely you see?"
"I see," said the other. "I see plainly."
"The new world," said Avery. It dazzles me. It rings like music in my ears."
"I see no new world," was the slow response.
The young face was plainly perplexed.
"Don't you believe?" he stammered. "After you have seen, I thought you would have the vision, would help me emancipate the world, save it."
His voice failed.
"Men have a way of crucifying their saviors," said the tired voice.
The inventor was suddenly indignant.
"You're blind," he said harshly.
It is too big for you. And I would have had you stand beside me in the great work. I shall announce it alone. There will be laboratories, enormous, and factories. My invention will be perfected, simplified, compressed. A generator will be made, thousands of horsepower to do the work of a city. Free thousands of men, made so small you can hold it in one hand. The sensitive face was proudly alight, proud and a trifle arrogant. The exultation of his coming power was strong upon him.
"Yes," said Professor Edinger, "in one hand." And he raised his right arm that he might see where the end of a sleeve was empty.
"I am sorry," said the inventor abruptly. "I didn't mean, but you will excuse me now. There is so much to be done."
But the thin figure of Professor Edinger had crossed to the far table to examine the apparatus there.
"Crude," he said beneath his breath. "Crude, but efficient."
In the silence, a rat had appeared in the distant corner. The professor nodded as he saw it. The animal stopped as the man's eyes came upon it, then sat squirrel-like on one of the shelves as it ate a crumb of food. Some morsel from a hurried lunch of Avery's, the professor reflected.
Poor Avery. Yes, there was much to be done.
He spoke as much to himself as to the man who was now beside him.
"It enters here," he said, and peered downward toward the lead bulb.
He placed a finger on the side of the metal.
"About here, I should think. Have you a drill and a bit of quartz?"
The inventor's eyes were puzzled, but the assurance of his old instructor claimed obedience. He produced a small drill and a fragment like broken glass. And he started visibly as the one hand worked awkwardly to make a small hole in the side of the lead. But he withdrew his own restraining hand, and he watched in mystified silence while the quartz was fitted to make a tiny window, and the thin figure stooped to sight as if aiming the opening towards a far corner, where a brown rat sat upright in the earnest munching of a dry crust. The professor drew Avery with him as he retreated noiselessly from the instrument.
"Will you close the switch?" he whispered.
The young man hesitated, bewildered at this unexpected demonstration, and the professor himself reached with his one hand for the black lever. Again the arc crashed into life, to hold for a brief instant until Professor Edinger opened the switch.
"Well?" demanded Avery. "What's all the show? Do you think you're teaching me anything? About my own instrument?"
There was hurt pride and jealous resentment in his voice.
"See," said Professor Edinger quietly, and his one thin hand pointed to a far shelf, where in the shadow was a huddle of brown fur and a bit of crust. It fell as they watched, and the plop of the soft body upon the floor sounded loud in the silent room.
"The law of compensation," said Professor Edinger. "Two sides to the medal. Darkness and light. Good and evil. Life and death." The young man was stammering.
"What do you mean? A death ray evolved? And what of it?" he demanded. "What of it? What's that got to do with it?"
"A death ray," the other agreed. "You have dreamed, Avery. One must in order to create, but it is only a dream. You dreamed of life, a fuller life for the world, but you would have given them, as you have just seen, death."
The face of Avery was white as wax. His eyes glared savagely from dark hollows.
"A rat!" he protested. "You have killed a rat, and you say...
He raised one trembling hand to his lips to hold them from forming the unspeakable words.
"A rat," said the professor, "or a man, or a million men."
"We will control it."
"All men will have it, the best and the worst, and there is no defense."
"It will free the world."
"It will destroy it."
"No,"
and the white-faced man was shouting now.
"You don't understand. You can't see."
The lean figure of the scientist straightened to its full height. His eyes met those of the younger man, silent now before him, but Avery knew the eyes never saw him. They were looking far off, following the wings of thought. In the stillness, the man's words came harsh and commanding.
"Do you see the cities?" he said. "Crumbling to ruins under the cold stars. The fields, they're rank with wild growth, torn and gullied by the waters.
a desolate land where animals prowl, and the people, wandering bands, lower as the years drag on, than the beasts themselves, the children dying, forgotten, in the forgotten lands, a people to whom the progress of our civilization is one with the ages past, for whom there is again the slow, toiling road toward the light. And somewhere, perhaps, a conquering race, the most brutal and callous of mankind, rioting in their sense of power and dragging themselves down to oblivion. His gaze came slowly back to the room and the figure of the man still fighting for his dream. "They would not," said Avery hoarsely. "They'd use it for good." "Would they?" asked Professor Edinger. He spoke simply as one stating simple facts. "I love my fellow men," he said, "and I killed them in thousands in the last war. I and my science and my poison gas." The figure of Avery slumped suddenly upon a chair. His face was buried in his hands. "And I would have been," he groaned, "the greatest man in the world." "You shall be greater," said the professor, "though only we shall know it. You and I, you will save the world from itself." The figure, bowed and sunken in the chair, made no move. The man was heedless of the kindly hand upon his shoulder. His voice, when he spoke, was that of one afar off, speaking out of a great loneliness. "You don't understand," he said dully. "You can't." But Professor Edinger, a cog in the wheels of a great educational machine, glanced at the watch on his wrist. Again his thin shoulders were stooped, his voice tired. "My classes," he said. "I must be going." In the gathering dusk, Professor Edinger locked carefully the door of his office. He crossed beyond his desk and fumbled with his one hand for his keys. There was a cabinet to be opened, and he stared long in the dim light at the object he withdrew. He looked approvingly at the exquisite workmanship of an instrument where a generator of the cathode ray and an intricate maze of tubings surmounted electromagnets and a round lead bulb. There were terminals for attaching heavy cables. It was a beautiful thing. His useless arm moved to bring an imaginary hand before the window of quartz in the lead sphere. "Power," he whispered and repeated Avery's words. "Power to build a city or destroy a civilization. And I hold it in one hand." He replaced the apparatus in the safety of its case. "The saviors of mankind," he said, and his tone was harsh and bitter. But a smile, whimsical, kindly, crinkled his tired eyes as he turned to his desk and its usual litter of examination papers. "It is something, Avery," he whispered to that distant man, "to belong in so distinguished a group."
This story was published in July of 1931 in Astounding Magazine. It would be 15 years later that the United States would begin testing the atomic bomb. Although this weapon was not quite that, it was pretty amazing that science fiction writers of that day had an inkling of what atomic power could do. Pretty scary stuff is my thought. What did you think? I encourage you to head to our Facebook page and chime in. Every once in a while, I like to give credit where credit is due and publicly thank Mr. Kevin MacLeod. Kevin is an American composer and musician. He has composed over 2,000 pieces of royalty-free library music and made them available under a Creative Commons copyright license. Kevin not only has provided 90% of the music you hear on Ron's Amazing Stories, but I also consider him a friend. As you may have noticed, we have a new segment, and if you guessed that Kevin wrote the music, you'd be right. Now, I wanted to play this piece in its entirety for your enjoyment, so here is I Can Feel It Coming by Kevin MacLeod, Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Arbitration 3.0 license. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. That's it for the podcast this time, and we've had another bundle of stories, for sure. My thanks again to Tom and Daniel for their tales. Coming up next, we'll have an OTR tale that I'm pretty excited about. See you next week. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There, you're going to find all of the links you'll need. We are on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many other services. Pick one and do leave some feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.